So yes, I'm going to talk about comparison of a current LIGO-Virgo data in O1 and O2 with binary isolated models. And I would like to show you what we can do with various pieces of information. And let me see what we can. So for double black holes, I would like to comment on merger rates, masses, and effective spins separately, because we can learn, or actually not learn much from some of those. And if I get a chance, I would like to finish with neutron stars, and that's a very different type of information I would like to discuss. It's a hot galaxy. So I'm not going to give much of an introduction. I don't think we need it here. But let's start with rates, and I will touch on both channels, so both major channels, so which is, you know, isolated binaries. Both are stars in the field of any galaxy, like spirals, ellipticals, or dwarf galaxies. And then opposite channel is dynamic interactions of various clusters, various stellar assemblies. So it goes to global clusters. I'm sure Carl will talk about that, open young clusters that Michelle was talking about, and also those huge oversized global clusters which are sitting in the center of some host galaxies. Those are nuclear clusters. Okay? So we have those two major channels, and the issue is we have those 10 black holes in LIGO detections right now, or maybe like 20 more, 10 more in O3, and we don't know where those black holes are coming from. Those both channels are giving us very different information in terms of conclusions. So I have one set of conclusions here, what those black holes are teaching us, and if they come from dynamic evolution, Carlos and Michelle will give us a different conclusions, and we don't know what to do with that. So it's actually hard to find a project that would take that information together and give us some, you know, meaningful information. Let's look just at rates for now. So if you calculate how many stars per unit, you know, by mass sits in isolated binaries in the field of galaxies, it's about 99% of stars by mass. If you look at global clusters, I'm just talking about global clusters right now, it's about 0.1 to 1% of stars. So we have about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more stars in that channel than this. However, the efficiency is much higher in dynamics. Per unit mass, you produce about 10 to minus 4 double black holes in dynamics, or you produce 10 to minus 6 in global clusters. It's still, you see that that thing wins. You have a 2 orders, 3 orders of magnitude more mass, but your efficiency is only 2 orders of magnitude lower. And that what shows up in detailed calculations. This is like a kind of, you know, hand-wavy proof of the stuff. Merger rates that are coming out of those channels are about 50 to 100 double black hole mergers per gigaparsec cube per year. Here, the typical merger rates are about 5 to 10. It's order of magnitude difference. So if I was to believe the current LIGO rates, which are about, you know, 50 peak of a distribution, I would say that about 90% of double black holes, so 9 of those 10, are coming from isolated binary evolution, and 1 is coming from dynamics. And I pretty much other exotic channels. I'm sure nature is providing us with so many black holes right now, probably all of them operate, but it will be hard to disentangle them. Okay? That's why I was asking Michela a question about rates, but not only rates, change of rates with redshift. So let's say, I think for, you know, merger rate from isolated binaries will peak, they follow star formation, so they will peak about redshift of 2. It's a short delay times. For global clusters, it will be unfortunately the same, because most of global clusters, formation of global clusters peaks also at redshift 2. It could be different for young clusters, so that there may be a chance here to look at different distributions. But when you think about this, well, people bring up population-free binaries, so primordial binaries, primordial stars with no metals, those peak at redshift 10. So there you could possibly, maybe not with LIGO, but with Einstein or Cosmic Explorer, when you will see two higher redshifts, you will see two populations standing out. One will be peaking at 2, another one at redshift 10, and then you can tell them apart. That's how we could possibly use rates, and they change with redshift to tell between populations. But so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to concentrate on those binaries, and I would try to tell you what you can actually learn from rates, masses, and spins, black hole spins, if all those LIGO observations, or one or two, those 10 observations come from the channel. So this is a big if. We don't know that. And it could be, it's possible that, let's say, dynamical channel dominates. So just keep that in mind. That's a big caveat here in the conclusions or statements that I'm going to make. So I'm going to start, like, you know, when we talk about evolution of binaries, we usually bring up common envelope and black hole natal kicks as limiting factors or most important factors that change the merger rates of double black holes. There is one more thing that we tend to overlook over the last years, and that's chemical metallicity evolution, pretty much chemical evolution throughout the universe. And that's what was noted by Martina Hruszlińska and Heis Nellemans this year. They used two different models for metallicity evolution in the universe to show how much you can change black hole rates. And the thing, trick is here that you don't change neutron-neutron star rates that don't depend on metallicity so much. So when you go to lower metallicity, black holes are more massive, so the rates are higher, but also evolutionary processes allow you to survive common envelope in a more efficient way at low metallicity. So you boost double black holes, but you don't change much for neutron stars. So you can play those tricks, and let me show you what are the uncertainties in the cosmic evolution of metals in stars for pop 1, pop 2 stars. I'm gonna leave away population 3 stars. If somebody's interested on that, please talk to me. So on this plot, I'm showing redshift from 0 from present time to about redshift 15, and this is logarithm of average metallicity in terms of a solar metallicity. And let's start with the black line. The black line shows you average cosmic metallicity evolution. It grows, of course, from redshift of about 15. That's where kind of population 2 stars start dominating, you know, starts entering the game. And it grows, and it becomes almost solar at redshift 0. That estimate comes from a number of observations, GRB supernovae, you know, AGNs, and a spectroscopy of gas at high redshift. A lot of observations, and that was collected by Maddow and Dickinson in 2014. So you see, it's kind of, it's a low curve, black curve, but you know, that thing was corrected by Piero Maddow in 2016. We've done a reanalysis of all the data, so that Maddow and Fragos 2016, and now they claim that the cosmic metal evolution is much higher, so it was much faster earlier on, it got to a high level, and it goes smoother to over solar average metallicity at current state. This is really important because black holes really, mass of the black holes and formation of double black hole mergers really depends on metallicity. So you can, changing those two by more than order of magnitude, you can change double black hole merger rates. And actually, I did the calculation for those two lines, and let me show you how merger rates are changing. So imagine you have the same evolutionary model, same common envelope, same black hole Nikel kicks, same IMF, everything the same, you just change it one factor. You go from one metallicity to the other, and to evolve all the stars in universe up to redshift 15, you check which ones are forming double black holes, you check where they merge, at which redshift, you have your synthetic LIGO detector, you have your waveforms, when you merge, you put the waveform on a double black hole, you have your sensitivity curve, you check, do I stick out, can LIGO see it, and then ask how many I will see with those two underlying models of two different metallicity evolutions. Okay, so this is the plot. So that plot shows, again, redshift from 0 to 15. And this one shows double black hole merger rate density, as LIGO measures, it's intrinsic, per gigaparsec cube per year. The black line corresponds to the model that had a lot of low metallicity stars. So I'm going to go back a slide that corresponds to that line. A lot of low metallicity stars all over the redshift, a lot of massive black holes, the rates are high. And you know, at the order locally at redshift 0, 1, the rates are about, you know, that's 100, that's 200, 200, 300. You already see it's beyond what LIGO measures. That's a green region. It's what LIGO is measuring right now from 0, 1, 0, 2. When you go to higher metallicity curve, when you enrich metals in, you know, when you enrich stars with metals much faster, you get those two curves, blue and red, depending how you treat extinction at a high redshift, doesn't matter. Up to redshift 2, those curves don't change, and they're much lower, up to order of magnitude lower than the previous curve. So just playing with metallicity evolution, no binary evolution, no stellar evolution, just chemical evolution. In universe, you can change rates by factor of 10. And then you can say, okay, fine, you have one curve, which is already outside of LIGO range for double black hole mergers. We learned something about chemical evolution. Not so easy. Then those other factors are coming in, binary evolution. Let me show you what black hole natal kicks and common envelope can do to you to actually take that conclusion from you. Because that would be a beautiful conclusion you can measure, you know, with LIGO, you can tell apart which chemical evolution is correct. No. So here we go. It won't be so pessimistic throughout the entire talk. So I will get to more positive points when I go farther down. But let me finish that one up. So I'm taking now this blue curve, okay, and I will play with evolutionary parameters. So for this blue curve, I kind of assume pessimistic common envelope. Not every star is allowed to survive common envelope. I kind of follow some of the Natasha prescriptions, and a lot of stars, especially after main sequence, they would not go through common envelope. They will not produce double compact object mergers. So black holes kind of, you know, intermediate values right in where you want within a LIGO range. Local merger rate is about 50 per gigaparsec per year. That's where a LIGO sees it. But now, if I allow common envelope for, let's say, stars just beyond main sequence, my rates will go up because a lot of binaries will survive common envelope, and that's that magenta curve. You see, I go order of magnitude up, and I'm already outside of a LIGO range. I can also, so that's going up, that's order of magnitude. Common envelope can do that to you. When I go from a blue line, which has almost no black hole kicks, very small black hole kicks, if any, I can start disrupting binaries, giving black hole higher natal kicks. If I give them natal kicks with a sigma, like a Maxwellian with a sigma of 130 kilometers per second, that's about half what is measured for double neutron stars, I will go from blue line down to black line. It's almost an order of magnitude. If I just go, you know, and say, well, maybe black holes, it's probably not realistic, but if I give all the black holes distribution of natal kicks that is measured for single pulsars in our galaxy, I go to red line, more than an order of magnitude change. So, you know, imagine this. I have that curve, I'm going back one slide, for previous metallicity evolution in the universe, but I give black holes a bit of kicks. I will go down to LIGO regime. So I cannot, and I don't think, you know, no matter how much LIGO will collapse that rate estimate, that's what people think. LIGO will collapse rate estimate, therefore we get a better constraint on binary physics. Not really. We have so many uncertainties in those cosmic evolution of metals, common envelope and black hole kicks, that you can, let's say if you decide on two, you can tell something about the third one. But not, you cannot tell about three of them at the same time. So we need to work in stellar evolution more to use LIGO rates. So LIGO rates are not that useful. Like I said, maybe the rise of those curves will tell us something. Change of rates with redshift will tell us something. Okay, that much about rates. Let me go to black hole masses. This is an interesting one right now, especially with gossips flying around that LIGO sees a 100 solar mass black hole, which I don't have it here, but I will show you what we can do with the masses that we have right now. So I'm not going to do an introduction to pre-instability pulsations, supernova pre-instability pulsations. I'm just going to show you three models for pre-instability pulsations that kind of limits the mass of a black holes, of a stellar mass black hole, stellar origin black holes, at about 50 solar masses, but we don't know if it's 40, 50, or 60. So what I've done, I use Ken's Nomoto group recent MESA predictions to come up, so to have a model which is called moderate perinstability pulsation supernovae, that's shown here magenta line, that tells you how much mass is left out of a helium core after the pulse, after the mass ejection. So here I have a helium core mass of a star that will go and form a black hole, and usually the hydrogen envelope is either lost with stellar winds or by binary companion, by common envelope, so we only are left with helium core. So if there was no pre-instability pulsation supernovae, I could keep almost all the helium core mass and collapse it to a black hole. But now it will be limited by pre-instability pulsation supernovae. So that magenta line shows original Ken's and his group calculation of how much you have left. So you see, you go to about maybe, you know, 55 solar masses of a helium core. Now, when you collapse it, you have a bit of neutrino emission. You may have some supernova explosion. You don't know how much, but I'm going to assume for my calculation that all of that stuff goes in, so when I compare it to LIGO. So it's kind of like a maximum upper limit on the black hole mass in that model. But I said, okay, well, we already have a lot of uncertainties in pre-instability pulsation supernova calculations, reaction rates, for example. I have two other models. One is a weak model that I allow only half of the mass loss that Ken is predicting, so I can get to 60 solar mass black holes, and have a strong PPSN, which gets me only 45 solar mass black holes. So now comparison to LIGO with those three models. Let's just look at the top panel, which shows a mass of a black hole 1 and mass of black hole 2 in a predicted black hole mergers, and those are some of my models, doesn't matter which right now. Those are showed with three different lines, and you see that blue line for strong peristability pulsation supernovae, black holes, individual masses of black holes go to about, you know, about 40, 45. Then you have another model, you go green, moderate, we go to about 50, and about 55, 60 for weak peristability pulsation supernovae. All those models are right now consistent with data. I'm showing here with magenta lines LIGO limits. And of course, you have LIGO mean, and you have LIGO 90% narrow limits, like as narrow as I can go within those limits, and as wide as I can go. So of course, if you want to make predictions, you take the narrow 90% ranges of masses from LIGO calibration, and you see that all those three models are fitting the LIGO data. Okay? So right now, we cannot tell this, but here, with more observations, getting those lines better, uncertainties better within LIGO, will actually help to measure where perinstability pulsation supernova gap begins. So that will be actually very useful to get more LIGO data. If we have hundreds of mass black holes, that's a very different story. So I'm going to finish with a last final thing, black hole spins, because here we can actually learn something already about the stars. So black hole natal spins will come from the evolution of a star and how much angular momentum you transport out of a star and throw out before you collapse to a black hole. And that's boils down to angular momentum transport problem, which we don't know for massive stars. We know something for master seismology, but only for low mass stars, but not for those massive guys. So what we do, we adopt three major models for angular momentum transport in stars. One is embedded in Geneva models, that's meridional currents. Angular momentum transport is kind of mild, so you keep a lot of angular momentum. And black hole spins for that model, depending on metallicity, depending, here it's a carbon oxygen core mass of a star that will collapse to black hole. You can treat it as a proxy for black hole mass. And here's a spin parameter, spin magnitude, J over mass of a black hole squared. You see that low mass black holes have high spins, about 0.9. High mass black holes have low spins, about 0.2. That's one model. And I'm going to oppose that against LIGO observation on the next slide. And here you have MESA model when you use much more efficient angular momentum transport, which is Tyrrell-Sprout magnetic dynamo. Angular momentum gets out to the surface and gets ejected pretty much with winds or by binary, you know, interaction. Look at the change of a scale. Here it was 0 to 1, so spin magnitudes for many black holes were close to, you know, maximal. Here it's 0 to 0.2. Most of the black holes have a spin of 0.1, much lower. And we have one more model from Jim Fuller who claims that this is, even this is not efficient enough according to astroseismology observations. And he assumes that all the black holes have very low spin, almost zero. Let's compare all those, let's put those black hole spins into the black holes that emerge in classical evolution channel, and well, let's calculate effective spin, because also some natal kick will give some misalignment, and oppose that against LIGO observations. So I have two slides left, recent. So here we go. So this is effective spin parameter, defined right here. I don't think I have to go through that parameter. Then you have a probability merger rate, you know, detection rate. Blue marks mark LIGO observations. Pretty much most of those events are pretty much consistent with the effective spin being zero. So black holes non-spinning. And here it's a model. Those two lines, magenta and red line, show classical evolution models when I use the Geneva angular momentum transport. You see what happens? Most of my black holes has high spins, high effective spins. It's totally inconsistent with what LIGO is seeing. But if I go to MESA model, you see, those my models will collapse to much narrower range of effective spins, and they seem to be consistent with LIGO. I'm not checking the shape of distribution, I'm just looking at the range right now. We'll check shape of distribution with 100 detections with all three. So now you can go ahead and say, what's for Jim Fuller's model? So I keep MESA model, that red line is the same, and Jim Fuller model with even more efficient angular momentum transport, it's even narrower. It may even be violating some 90% LIGO limits, but we don't know. You, of course, those two models, to my red models, don't include tides on Wolf-Rayet stars, the effective tides that were brought up by Donald Cushing and Matthias Zarydaga. If I put those tides, I can spin up some stars, and instead of producing low spinning black holes, I can produce high mass and high spinning black holes, and this is that curve. I get additional peak at about 0.5, 0.6. So that's where, you know, some of the high spinning black holes could fit. So we actually know already from those things that if those LIGO black holes are coming from classical evolutionary binary channel, angular momentum transport needs to be effective in stars. And a lot of those LIGO black holes will form without spin, almost without spin, 0.1, 0.2. So I'm going to stop here. Thank you.
I mean, I think everyone agrees that the angular momentum in these systems is very important, but we also have observational constraints. And Chris Fryer yesterday mentioned that. from the black hole binaries. So you are dismissing all those spin measurements like GS9015 or Cygnus X1?
No. So we have an issue here that was LIGO black hole seems to be rotating slowly. Okay? And we have at least three high mass X-ray binaries, Cygnus X1, M33X1, and LMC. They rotate at 0.7, 0.8, and Cygnus X1 0.99. The question is, how can you reconcile those two? And that case was actually done this year by Tassos Fragos. The proposal here is the following. Those binaries come from wide systems, thousands of solar radii apart, so they are not really subject to tidal interactions early on. So they, angular momentum getting transported out, get ejected, and they form low-spinning black holes. For high-mass X-ray binaries, Tassos proposed something different. You start at 100 solar radii instead of thousands, and when the primary star, which is supposed to form a black hole, is on the main sequence, it almost reaches Roche lobe and it's tidally locked. So you transport angular momentum, as in MESA, out, and you get rid of it, but your binary orbital energy is spinning the star up till the end of main sequence. After main sequence, you still have a highly spinning star, which collapses to high-spinning black hole. So at different populations, LIGO and high-mass X-ray binaries. And when I looked at high-mass X-ray binaries that we know, all those that you mentioned, and I did forward evolution and asked a question, is any one of them going to make double black hole?
No.
Black hole neutron star, maybe. Cygnus X1.
Okay.
Just a follow-up question. Does it mean that... So what about chemically homogeneous clusters?
That is the... So chemical evolution, you can have that. However, this seems to be contradicting chemically homogeneous evolution because you want really high spins and highly aligned spins. So chi effective close to one. So if you see one or a few of them, yes, I would totally agree that that's chemical evolution. I would expect
that's
one in...
actually not true. For the high metal, you see the typical spin would be 0.2 to 0.6.
Okay, here you go. Okay, I didn't know that. Thank you.
We have that in our 2016 paper already.
But... sorry, I did must have missed that. Sorry.
What is your prescription for getting misalignment angles here, and how sensitive is that to various choices? How much can this chi-effective distribution change?
So misalignment will come with natal kicks. Red line here, for example, for MESA models, shows you almost no black hole natal kicks. Magenta will show you full natal kicks, like I give to, you know, full neutron star kicks. The range doesn't change, of course. What you change the average. You go to lower values. In MESA model, you go from average for that red curve is effective in 0.15. You shift it by a factor of 2 to lower things. And of course, here for MESA model, you have much broader distribution of spins. You produce many more negative spins because you misalign black holes highly. So actually, it's possible to produce double black holes in classical evolution with negative spins, just probability is very low. Those are logarithmic scales.
The degeneracies that you mentioned by bringing in metallicity evolution, etc., could that be broken at least partially by considering the rate of, say, GRBs or supernovae, assuming some of these black holes could be coming up with, formed with supernovae GRBs?
GRBs are very special events, one in 1,000, one in few hundreds. So I don't think they affect very much. Supernovae maybe will be a better constraint. But we definitely do need, I don't think LIGO is going to constrain much those things until we get some constraints from electromagnetic observations, either supernovae or GRBs, and we constrain common envelope black hole natal, black hole natal kicks. So yes, somewhere, or theoretical work, of course. If, Natasha or Philip will come give me, this is the common envelope, that's the only model you can use, I will be doing much, much better. Or somebody comes, Chris Fry, tells me, this is the only model for black hole natal kicks, perfect.
We'll help you to kill Hertzsprung gap, right?
Yeah.
I go. Chris, I'm still, unfortunately, quite skeptical that stellar evolution models can be predictive on the final spins here. I mean, you've shown that if you use the Geneva, things don't work. If you use other two models, things work. But even MESA, I'm quite sure that tweaking some of the parameters, you can get completely different predictions. So can you comment on this?
That's 100% sure. This is just showing order of magnitude result. If you use an efficient angular momentum, you produce high. You don't need to do calculations. I've just done the calculation to do presentation. I cannot say that. So if you do mild angular momentum transport, you weigh out from LIGO observations. But when you use semi-coefficient, whether it's a Jim Fuller's model or Tyler's put dynamo without saturation, like Jim is using, you seem to be getting much better. So I definitely do not believe any particular model of momentum transport. We don't really know. But this is the case when actually LIGO encryptional waves are teaching us something useful that we haven't got for decades of studies, and we will not see in astroseismology, because those massive stars are so kind of fuzzy. You cannot measure those pulsations. You cannot do astroseismology and go in. The most massive star that actually was done with astroseismology is 9 solar masses. So it's just starting to probe neutron star formation. But we're talking here about 50, 100 solar mass stars. So no, you're 100% true. But that gives people at least direction in which to move angular momentum transport. That's it. And this is beautiful because that's with 10 detections. So that can get much better. We can learn something about, you know, when we see some outliers, it could be either chemically homogeneous evolution, the spins that Philip was just talking about, or it could be just tides on Wolf-Rayet star, for example. Okay, that will also make the distribution much broader.
You know, high mass X-ray binaries may end up evolving, you know, into black hole neutron star systems. So is that the dominant channel in these models? I mean, it's not like the prediction would be that those might have preferentially higher spins than the black hole binaries. And so I'm wondering, is this the Tasso's channel to sort of consider the dominant one in these models?
No. Well, Tasso's just proposed that channel as a possible explanation of the high spins. I looked at the system. The most known system is Cygnus X1. It has a 15 solar mass black hole and about 20 solar mass O star at the end of main sequence or beginning of hard, or just right after main sequence. If a black hole is spinning like 0.99, and we have distance, we have everything to that system. If you go through, it's closed system, so you go through Rorschach power flows, you remove some mass from the 20 solar mass star, it will most likely form a neutron star. 70% of times when you apply neutron star kicks, you will disrupt. 30% of times you stay bound. But out of those 30% of times, 1% you only on such an orbit that you measure within Hubble time. So whether it's a dominant channel or not, I don't know. Because we only see one Cygnus X1, you need to really sample all high mass X-ray binaries and follow the evolution. But it's definitely possible to form black hole neutron star with a high spinning black hole and a low spinning neutron star.
Just any comments on BNS rates?
Yes, so there we get BNS rates right now between 100 and 500, so we have no problem with LIGO. You can disconnect me. The only issue we have, it's a host galaxy, because so rates we get. The LIGO rates we get within, you know, LIGO 90% credible limits. The problem we have, it's getting a first or you know, significant population of double neutron star mergers in elliptical galaxies that are very old, because our delay times are like T2 minus 1 or T2 minus 2, therefore we expect most of neutron star mergers in spirals or star-forming galaxies. And most of the GRBs, 60 to 80%, are in star-forming galaxies as opposed to ellipticals. So I see a conflict here. People don't. It's only one observation, so I guess we'll have to wait.
Just as a reminder, the first four short GRBs that were localized, three were in elliptical galaxies.
Exactly.
People were making the same comment that this is a disaster.
And I was on the other side of the story. Yes, I know.
So those statistics tend to work themselves out.
Yes. So maybe we don't have a problem. But merger rates are fine.